Hello everyone, my name is Vlad Glavanu. I'm the Head of Psychology and Counseling at Webster University Geneva and Director of the Webster Center for Creativity and Innovation. And it's my great pleasure to be here today together with Professor Anna Abraham, who is Professor of Psychology at the School of Social Sciences in Leeds Beckett University. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
So we're going to talk about creativity, obviously, a bit of imagination, and something that has to do a lot with your past and recent work around the neuroscience of creativity and imagination. But before we go into that, I'm curious to know, how did you get to the topic of creativity?
My interest stemmed from the fact that I've always been interested in the creative arts.
Yes.
So as a kid, as an adult, I've always enjoyed different forms of creativity, whether it was through books or film or music or visual art. So it was something that I was always dabbling in or interested in directly or indirectly. And when I got to university and had the chance to think about doing a PhD, it was really all I wanted to do was to study creativity. So if I couldn't be a creative artist directly, at least I could get to study it indirectly. And so I just wanted to understand how it is that we're capable of being creative at all and express it in so many different ways, and to get to understanding that.
And what got you to the neuroscience in particular? Obviously, there are multiple approaches to this topic. What does the neuroscience of creativity bring to the whole debate about creativity?
Well, for me, I think it was sort of coincidental, because when I was looking for PhDs, I was very open in terms of perspectives I would adopt, because of course I knew nothing. And I was always, and when the opportunity came up to apply for a fellowship for a PhD in neuroscience, that seemed very multidisciplinary. I don't know why I found it interesting, but I did. And I thought this sounded amazing, to be studying neuroscience, but being in a student cohort where no two people have the same background.
Yes.
It's very different from other types of learning that you do. So if you're in psychology undergrad, you're surrounded by psychology undergrads and so on. This is very different in the PhD situation that I went into. And so it was an opportunity that presented itself. And I still wanted, as long as I was studying creativity, I didn't much care what kind of perspective I applied, almost. But that's because I thought, well, I'm willing to study from a cognitive perspective, from a sort of a classical empirical perspective. And neuroscience is, I did want to study it empirically. So neuroscience offered an opportunity to study it empirically, but I didn't really think too hard about why that would be useful, because I didn't know enough about the power of the approach. I did know that I wanted to study, understand things like, you know, this idea that we have that creativity is linked to mental illness. So I knew that neuroscience approach would be particularly promising in that respect, because of course, when you think about mental illness, psychosis in particular, you can't think about it without considering the brain as well. So it seemed to me a perfect kind of synergy that came about, but it was very coincidental. And so it allowed me to pursue what was just generic interest, curiosity, but use tools that I was unfamiliar with, but could get a lot of training in.
I'm gonna ask you also a kind of devil's advocate type of question.
Sure.
Because I specialize definitely not in the opposite of neuroscience, because there's no opposite of that, but in the other end of the spectrum, which is the societal part. And I know that there are people who believe that creativity is very much more of a social convention. So one question is, what do we actually study when we look at creativity and the brain? I mean, would you say that we use, how can we study that, right? Is it a simplified version? How do people study creativity in relation to the brain?
Well, in, I think, again, when you look at the brain in terms of any function, whether it's creative or non-creative function, what you want to basically understand is what is happening in your head when this is going on. Now, psychologists have always been interested in it. We never had any tools to test this directly by any means. We just looked at the kind of answers people were reporting verbally or by reacting quickly or accurately through like sort of basic response measures. And we could sort of indirectly weave together some sort of tale. So if they take longer at this type of task, that has a higher processing demand, or, you know, those sorts of intuitions we had. With neuroscience, what we were able to, and this is kind of a psychologist's dream, if you want to understand the brain, it gives you the sense that you're getting a closer look at what's going on. So you go, you have the behavior, and you can see what's happening in the brain in terms of there's activity in these regions, or more likely, it's even more indirect than that. It's blood flow to these regions, which we assume with pretty good justification means that there's activity going on there. The problem with the neuroscientific approach then, though, is that it escapes easy translation. So just because an area is activated, that area is not only activated for creative tasks, for instance. Right. So it's activated for a range of different tasks. It begs the question of how much can we understand about it using that. And a lot of the time we are very, let's say, we tend to be very constrained but what we already know about the brain. So if we know that this area X does this function, if we see that a creative task activates area X, then we say, oh, it involves that function. So it's necessarily, it limits the way we think because there's so little known about the brain. Having said that, what neuroscience actually reveals that is very, very powerful about the approach is that, you know, you can think of as many functions as there are words, right? Yes. So when we look at what happens when you're being creative, the psychological theorizing about it has always been pretty, has assumed that there's something about this function that's very special, that's higher than everything else. That's the epitome of human achievement. And there are good reasons to think that way intuitively. What the brain-based approach tells you is that this is not as simple as that. In fact, you can't think of creativity without thinking of quite basic operations. You can't think of... It gives you a clearer, less sort of, you know, glorified view of creativity.
A mystical kind of
view. It makes you consider creativity. You can't think of creativity without thinking of other aspects of perception, action, cognition, and so on. So it brings it down to earth, as far as I'm concerned, and allows you to say, well, if I'm talking about creativity, I can't not talk about language, for instance. I can't not think about attention. I can't just not consider what happens when I have when I'm thinking about my own past, or when I'm contemplating semantic processing, and so on. So it doesn't allow us to see it as something separate from everything else, which we're very, very tempted to do because it seems so mystical. It forces us to consider how it relates to everything else. So I think that is the power of the neuroscientific approach, in that it gave us those insights that were previously lacking.
Very interesting. And for our listeners who might not be very used to even imagining, you know, a bit of how that research is done, would you say that there is a traditional paradigm in which these things tend to be studied? So what kind of a creative task? What is the process of looking at what happens in the brain as you create, as you do something? How would you explain briefly the methodology?
Yeah, there are a range of tasks that are used. And typically what sets apart creativity tasks from tasks that don't assess creativity is that there's no right or wrong answer.
Yes.
So typically it's not a yes or no response or a rating response. Tell me how you feel from, you know, how much pain are you feeling? Give me a rating from 1 to 5, for instance. All of those kinds of objective measures are typically lacking in creativity tasks. There are types of creativity tasks that have objective responses, but they're quite limited. But there are a range of tasks that are verbal tasks and nonverbal tasks. There are perhaps the most famous task is called the alternative uses task, where you tell people to think of unusual uses for common objects. So let's say for a paperclip, you ask them to think of, you have a customary use for a paperclip, which is to put things together and fix them together. And you tell people to think of as many uses as they can, alternative uses, unusual uses that they can. And then what you will assess is how many uses they came up with, for instance. So that would be called fluency is the word for it. Another thing you would look at is the originality or the unusualness of the use. That can be assessed in a range of different ways. So already the difficulty in assessing creativity starts there.
Yes.
Because a range of, depending on where you've trained or where you study or what your perspective is, you could assess originality differently. So the this task is a very, very old task. And originally what it was assessed by was a very objective way. It's the kind of way that I prefer to look at as well, where you would look at how many people generated a particular use.
Yeah.
And a use was given an originality rating of 1 if that use was only generated by that one person.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But you need big samples.
You need big samples. And so typically for children, that's what you had. Alternatively, you could also make it, the kind of approach I use is to give a rating for each use. So some uses are generated by many people, some uses are generated by few people, and depending on how often that use has come up, it gets an originality index.
Yes.
Yeah. So then you can calculate in a slightly more objective way, still objective way, but you're not losing 99% of your data that just becomes a zero.
Exactly.
You're getting a more nuanced understanding of it. Other people go for very subjective ratings. So they give that list of uses to somebody else, a couple of people, mm-hmm. to rate it in terms of their creativity, how creative they consider that to be. The problem with that approach is, of course, your rating is as good as your rater, or your two mm-hmm. raters in terms of how unanimous they are. It doesn't necessarily reflect what's really creative. And we know the problem with subjectivity and creativity is you need a lot of domain. You know, there's domain expertise makes a huge difference. I've used subjective measures as well, and I'm very, very keenly aware of it really does matter who the rater is, and so on. So, but you can get an index of how unusual the uses are. So you can get a sort of indication of how fluent a person is in producing uses, how original they are. And for me, these are the basic things that you would look at. There are other tasks that are more problem-solving based.
Mm-hmm.
So you give people an open-ended problem where the answer is not obvious, and they have to work their way through it to find this less obvious answer.
Yeah.
And in those kinds of situations, what you're looking at is, for instance, how is problem-solving in a creative mode different from a non-creative mode? If we're problem-solving all the time, how do we know that it's different when you're trying to do something? It's a creative problem that you're doing. So there are certain indices, for instance, the studies looking at metacognition, that means your awareness of your own thought processes. So for instance, when they have people indicate how close you think to the answer, answering this problem, people are pretty accurate when it's a non-creative task, when it's just a regular analytical problem that, the kind of typical kind of logical problem that you can give someone to solve that they just have to work out, let's say like a math problem. People are pretty good at saying, oh, well, I'm far away from the answer now, 15 seconds later, I'm a little bit closer. So you see this closer approximations, that sort of serial that gets to the answer. It goes from 1 to 2 to 5 and 7, and then 10 is when they're pretty sure they're close to the answer. For a creative problem, which, for instance, is, things like the alternative uses task, but applied in a different way, where the answer is not as obvious, people don't really have a clear sense of when they're reaching the problem, or they have a sudden insight that they get about suddenly the solution drops. So it's like a leap from 4 to 10. It's not gradual. So that's one indication that when you're solving a problem creatively, fundamentally something different is happening. It's a little less linear. It's a little less predictable.
Exactly.
And that's obvious from the responses. Another way to understand creativity in terms of problem solving is when you have people verbalize, tell you about their problem-solving processes. When you're trying to verbalize it in a non-creative task, it doesn't interfere with your ability to solve the problem. When you're trying to verbalize it in a creativity task, it does impair your ability to solve the problem. You get slower at it, almost because you need these sort of semi-conscious things and processes to intermingle and to be undisturbed in a way. When you're trying to explain something to somebody, you're trying to consciously access everything in a way as to make it logical and sensible.
Yes, of course.
But that doesn't necessarily work towards creativity. So there's a range of tasks. There are many tasks that are drawing-based that are used a lot. There are also tasks that are, let's say, the kind of thing that the listener might be more familiar with, is the kind of technique that is used a lot in reality TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know what the Swiss version would be of Pop Idol and so on.
I don't know.
But, you have contestants performing and you have a judging panel who are considered to have expertise in that domain. And they judge whether this person can continue to the next round and so on. That's a kind of based loosely perhaps on Teresa Mirbalay's consensual assessment technique, which is you get people to raise, but that's at the level of the product. You're looking at, what makes this person's performance or this work of art or this book better than the others around.
And when people do this, divergent thinking tasks, inside problems, and so on, what are you monitoring in terms of brain activity? So you mentioned blood flow. What other things are indicators of activity? What do we measure in relation to the brain?
Well, in terms of brain function, you're really just looking at brain activity typically. So you can look at, that's not completely true. You're looking at, in terms of, mainly we look at brain activity that can be related, that can be a kind of direct measure. So I'm performing the task, and while I'm performing it, my brain is being scanned. And I'm looking at where the blood flow is going, or if it's EEG, it's actually looking at electrical potentials, the aftermath of that, and so on. It's more direct. Or I can look at, I can have people do these kinds of tasks, and then I can look at brain structure, just take scans of the structure of their brains, and look at density of gray to white regions, and so on. Look at sort of structural elements and look at whether there's a correlation between structural elements in certain brain regions and their performance on these divergent thinking tasks, for instance. Yes. That's structural neuroimaging. It's different from functional neuroimaging.
Okay.
Now the all the rage is to also look at something in between, I would say, almost, which is you look at how people's brains are active during rest, and then you correlate their performance to either creativity task or even how they are when they're functionally activated during the task. That's also an indication of, because there's this idea longstanding that, you know, there might be something more trait-based about differences between creativity. So I may not be able to see, differentiate between, let's say, a person who's highly creative and not as creative when they're performing the creative task.
Yeah.
There might be something about the way my brain is per default in terms of the way it's activated, that allows me to be creative in general in my life. That's not task specific, but it should correlate with something on the task. This is how these sorts of neuroscientific techniques are used. You can also look at patients, neurological patients, patients who have, people who have lesions to certain parts of their brain. Then that's a neuropsychological approach. That's been used for a very, very long time. It has a much longer history than neuroimaging, for instance, because people have always come across historically patients with certain forms of lesions and who have certain dysfunctions that can be personality-based, language-based, and so on. There are historical studies in psychology and neurology where critical patient data has told us a lot about where in the brain something happens. So we know from, you know, the idea of Broca's aphasia and Wawrinka's aphasia came from the study of patients who had difficulties in speech production but not speech comprehension, and alternatively speech comprehension but not speech production. The same thing is applied in the case of creativity. So you can look at people who have certain forms of lesions and look at their creative performance. So the most widely studied group is probably patients with the disorder that is called frontotemporal dementia. This is a certain dysfunction where parts of the frontal most part of your brain, in the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe, start to atrophy, start to get degenerate. It's a neurodegenerative disorder. And in a very small subset of these patients, what happens is that they start to develop incredible artistic skills post-stroke that they never exhibited before, right? Yeah. So this is, and what's interesting is, of course, that A, it doesn't happen to all the patients. It's with that kind of presentation, only a subset. The question is why. But when it does happen, it's really quite striking, and it's quite compulsive, and it doesn't die down. In fact, a lot of them go on to become artists.
Yeah.
So that's fascinating. There are lots of cases of brain damage and how it relates to a release of artistry, or what, or for instance, you can also look at patient groups, people with certain lesions in certain parts of the brain, and give them the kind of creativity tasks, the divergent thinking tasks, the problem-solving tasks, and see how they perform relative to people with typical functions who have no brain injury. And what you can see is, and when they perform differently, either worse or better, you can understand much more about what that, the role of that brain region in that particular creative function.
And this brings me, and I think I've kind of been guiding this interview towards this question now, right? Brings me to the question of what do we know so far? Of course, we might know a lot. We might actually not know as much as we want to know. But what are some findings in terms of looking perhaps at that normal, inverted commas, population that you study in relation to brain functioning when people create, ideate, or do other things? What is there a consensus reached at the moment, or are we still looking for broad patterns?
I think the consensus is reached about very small. I don't think there's no any consensus about creativity at large because it's not been studied enough. Most of the studies on creativity have been on what we call domain general creativity. So we have these kinds of tasks of creativity that have been created in order to study creative thinking, but they don't really relate to domain-specific creativity. So I could say, when I'm performing the alternative uses task in the scanner, I know that certain brain networks tend to be activated, but it tells me very little about what a what's happening in a composer's brain when he's composing a piece of music, or what happens in a musician's brain when he or she is improvising, or what's happening in a writer's brain when she's sitting in front of her computer for 2 years trying to write a book. You know, there are so many things that we absolutely do not know. So as far as I'm concerned, there's no consensus on anything beyond perhaps a very small slice of what we're able to assess using these techniques. And what is known, though, is also very complicated.
Yes.
necessarily so. That's
the kind of thing. Let me ask you then, one of the big myths and images is the idea of the right hemisphere, left hemisphere.
Sure.
So where do we stand there in terms of the analytical brain creative brain?
I think this is still a polarizing topic, surprisingly so. And so the answer would depend on who you ask. For me, it's always been a fascinating thing that people in psychology and that people can look at the same pieces of evidence and come to different conclusions. And that has always surprised me. In my own work, it's quite clear that there's no evidence that the right brain is the creative brain and the left brain is not. And I have to stress that the people who studied hemispheric differences from the start have talked about the importance of both hemispheres.
Okay.
From the beginning. It's just that at the time when they were doing it, the left brain was considered, you know, the cool one, because it was getting a lot of focus from language researchers.
Okay.
And the right hemisphere was sort of disregarded. And the creativity researchers were saying, hey, this is important. Somewhere in that argument, it became oversimplified and it was argued that the right brain is the creative brain.
Yeah.
And that's not what the earliest researchers, and if you really go down and look at, none of them have argued that.
Yes.
They've always argued for bilateral function, that both hemispheres are important. And this is kind of, and that's actually what makes creativity kind of unique, because there are a lot of functions that are very strongly lateralized to the left hemisphere or the right hemisphere. So most aspects of language processing, if you're a right-handed person, are left lateralized, for instance. When it comes to motor function, there's a clear lateralization depending on what limb is moving and so on. Creativity is special in many ways because it really is a joint hemispheric kind of contribution that is going on there. So it really just, so part of it is really about what is being emphasized, and in delivering this answer, people, you know, especially in, and I'm not saying it's just the media, it's very often the scientists themselves, but it's oversimplified. And then if you're trying to do some sort of sound bite, it becomes an easy sell, and then it becomes mythical almost, right?
So, and then it becomes training programs that look at one side of the brain, and it gets translated into industry, into publicity, and so
I mean, the answer is that it's not untrue, but it's also not true. So it does involve the right brain, but it doesn't only involve the right hemisphere.
I think that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Also, but not only.
Yeah.
And you have an up-and-coming book, The Neuroscience of Creativity with Cambridge University Press, and you're also in preparation editing a handbook on imagination. And I wanted to ask you, where does imagination fit into all of this? A very big question, but is imagination, you look at it as partially, you know, overlapping with creativity, quite different from it, one and the same thing, where...
Well, it's really like looking at the world through different lenses, if you want. Imagination in terms of psychology is almost too widely construed, which is why psychologists don't talk about the imagination
at all.
It's surprising, but it doesn't happen. But let's say with philosophers, for instance, they've always grappled with the notion of where does imagination fit? How does it relate to perception and so on? And very, very early ideas have emphasized that there is no perception without imagination. Imagination starts right at the start because it's really about filling in the blanks. In the psychological sphere, when we think about imagination, it's very often applied kind of synonymously with creativity, which is definitely false because imagination is not only creativity. And also, creativity is a very complicated process. So a lot of it has to do with imagination, but a lot of it has to do with just sculpting and finalizing and doing the most appropriate. So it's not only imaginative. There's other components that many people would argue is not necessarily wholly imaginative.
Yes.
So they overlap, but I would say that the most natural way to think of it is that creativity is one, the imaginative brain, the imaginative mind is used in service of so much of our function. Creativity is one aspect of it, but there's very uncreative aspects of our imagination as well.
Yeah, more, well, reproductive in a classical sense, although even there you might think that there is a creative end they might be put to.
Exactly. Yeah. So imagination is much wider, less well-studied, much more abstract, and that's saying a lot considering how little we know about creativity.
So you went for that challenge.
I think for me was the neuroscientific approach particularly was informative for me and showed me that it's not possible to really think about creativity unless you relate it to other aspects, fundamental aspects of human function, which is cognition and imagination. And even more than that, you know, I don't even think that you could think about it in terms of not thinking about the motor system anymore, the perceptual system. I feel like you kind of have, and then to go beyond that in terms of considering the environment and society and so on. So if you really want to have a sense of what this is, you need to understand how it relates to everything else, because nothing happens in isolation.
Yeah.
And so imagination was sort of the logical extension from where I was sitting to try and think of how does... what is creativity? How does it relate to what is a creative imagination compared to an uncreative imagination? What does that tell me? How does other aspects of creativity that are not imagination, not necessarily creative, say imagery, it's not necessarily creative. How does that feed into creativity? We know that it does based on a lot of anecdotal evidence. For instance, alone, we know that a lot of people report that imagery is very vital to their creative process.
Yeah.
So you're talking about aspects of imagination that feed into the creative mode, but are not necessarily creative in and of themselves. But maybe they are, you know, so we don't even have the vocabulary really to try and understand how all of this goes. So the handbook is really about getting experts to tell me what they think is happening, how they conceive of this. And then perhaps to take it forward. It's just a starting, you know, a starting point at which we can grapple with it at a wider level. So it's very interesting to me how, from a neuroscientific perspective, it's so narrow what we consider to be imaginative, right?
Yeah.
So if you look at different traditions in terms of how they study the imagination, the only thing that has been studied very well, the only aspect of imagination that has been studied very well across disciplinary perspectives is imagery.
Yeah.
Every other aspect has been more or less studied. So in psychology, there's a lot on daydreaming, for instance. It's not that much of a topic elsewhere. There's much more about creativity in the psychology sphere. Philosophers classically don't really talk about creativity, surprisingly enough, and so on. So it's interesting for me to see how different types of experts, depending on their expertise, come to the topic, and they can come to it with wildly different kind of takes on how to consider different aspects of imagination, the way that I conceive of it, is, and in some of the contributions, they've clearly not agreed with it and have come up with their own. And it's just been really kind of an interesting exchange to see how that works, or the need to consider wider elements than typically inward-looking disciplines like philosophy and psychology and neuroscience are very much just like there's nothing outside the body. And there are other perspectives, including yours, which are like, well, you just there is no sense in not contextualizing things.
Exactly. Well, I actually, the more I listened, well, and the conversations we're having and your written work and the work of others in this area, I can see fruitful parallels that need to be, maybe the third project in the future would be to really build more solid bridges there. Because what you said about how creativity involves much more than cognition per se, imagination even per se, and so on, it's how we in social cultural psychology talk about creativity as action or activity. So this is the activity system. Action involves everything at once. It's the human being engaged in a certain intentional, or intentionality can be more or less vague and, you know, relating you to an external environment in some way. So it is this complexity that I think both sides are grappling with. And one thing we talked about before was also something interesting about aging when we talked outside of the podcast. So I was curious if you could say a few things about the relation between imagination or creativity and old age, which is a topic that hasn't been studied much, as far as I know.
Yeah, it's something that I'm beginning to look at in my own work. I think what's interesting, it's not well studied, so we really don't know much. Mm. But what seems to be an indication so far is that creativity is one of those abilities that that seems to not be as affected by aging. So we know that the human system, unfortunately, is such that post the age of, I don't know, 40, everything starts to deteriorate very slowly and then quite quickly. But all of our faculties, you know, you get cognitively slower, you become there are all these slopes in every single domain. What is interesting about creative function, and we know this from brain damage patients as well, the fact alone that, for instance, a lot of people suffer from stroke. They tend to be on the older side when they do. And if they were artists before, they don't stop producing.
Yeah.
They continue to produce. There is something about the brain that's pretty disease resistant when it comes to creativity.
Mm-hmm.
It's, and a lot of neurologists in the field who talk about this is what they're and I'm always amazed that it doesn't get more press, because it is fascinating that something that we consider so complex and so the epitome of everything that human beings are and so on and so forth is so resistant to breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's almost as, so you can see that when a system breaks down, people find new ways to create, and people who were doing it don't lose it. They continue to do it. And there are very famous case studies of artists and painters in the neurological literature that are beautiful case studies to show this. Now, so there's something then to suggest that they're aging, although in many, many cases, in most cases, in all functions, has a deleterious effect. It's not. We're never going to be at our cognitive peaks, typically, at the age of 60.
Yeah.
But there's something resistant about creativity in that domain. Now, there are people who have found no difference, and some people who have found some differences. Again, it's not well studied. For me, the kind of work that I've done, we found that older people actually have advantages. In that they're better at fluency and originality than younger people. I mean, we're looking at much older cohorts than what people typically look like, people over the age of 75. But the testing conditions do make a difference. So typically when you test, and we know this with children and with patient populations as well, typically when you test in these studies, we give people an upper limit of 2 minutes and so on. And if you're a young person used to the university systems, we usually typically test university students, for instance, they're used to the sort of question-answer situation. With patient populations, with children and so on, you have to give them more free rein. and allow them more time. And there's a range of evidence in psychological literature to show that if you delimit the amount of time people get, they have fewer sort of original responses coming out. There is this time-based originality effect that the ideas you produce early on are less original, less unique than the ideas that you produce later on. So this has kind of a huge effect if you think, if you're a person who's cognitively slower, it might take you a while to produce your ideas, but if you don't have the time to, you're not going to be able to show it. So I think what the strength, so when we look at studies that have not, that have shown no differences or not, or poor performance, we need to consider sort of situational factors, like how are you being tested? Is this a valid way to test this in that population? So I'm looking at aging in order to, and I, what I'm interested in that is in a very long-term way, so think if creative abilities are protected, we can use that actually as an avenue in which to sort of reverse the effects of other kinds of deleterious effects of other types of dysfunctions, such as memory and so on, the kind of memory dysfunctions that you see. Now, they apply this in, it's very widely applied in cases like music therapy in the case of aphasia. So people who have disruption in their language function as a result of, you know, some form of injury to the brain, typically a stroke. What happens is that they have very specific types of language problems. Either they can't understand well or can't produce well, produce language, or it's a combination of both. And very often, speech therapy is very difficult in these cases. So the reverse approach is to try and use music. And music therapy is extremely widely used in the rehabilitation of aphasia because it's kind of an understanding of parallel circuitry being involved in music and language, but music is much more multimodal. So all of the connectivity that is unimpaired in the musical situation can be used to trigger language function.
Interesting.
So that's very widely used, for instance. So we could think about doing something similar in the case of aging, if creative, if we find that creativity is actually, abilities are actually protected, to say, okay, how, but a lot of other functions are going to seed, as they say in English. Is there a way to abet those functions by using creativity, creative function as that route? So I'm very interested in, you know, in the power of creativity across the lifespan, in terms of improving our well-being and improving other functions as well. So one particularly useful group to look at would be older adults. And honestly, older adults are a delight to test. They're so happy to participate. We never had any problem getting anybody there. And they're so, so grateful to be doing something where they're actually... The great thing about creativity testing is that you don't get an indication that you're particularly good or bad at anything because there's no right or wrong answer. Typically, I think older people are so used to, you know, being aware of their memory failing and their attention being more inattentive about things, that when they're doing a task that they're actually enjoying doing and find, oh, I'm doing okay at this, it's a huge boost for them. I think that alone is a great indication of how we can use these sorts of functions.
And I think this is also a beautiful example of how sociocultural and neuroscience approaches could collaborate, because all of this boost comes out of a kind of social appreciation and the way in which identity is built and the way, you know, social attention is given, that can actually collaborate with all these mechanisms you're talking about. On this positive high note, I'm going to thank you again very much, Anna.
I've been talking
to Anna Abraham, who's professor of psychology at the School of Social Sciences in Leeds Beckett University. And if you would like to know more about creativity, imagination, and related topics, do visit our podcast at podcast.webster.ch. Thank you very much again.
Thank you.